How's that?
I think
one day I feel so.
Well, look, thank you.
Now, what would be my story if that were the case?
Oh, no. So, that's not what I meant.
You can, but I can't answer it.
And there was this indescribable welter of emotions.
I think
to this day
I will never accept
it. It was like something that
never
just sort of snapped in my head.
And look, I don't know. It's a miracle.
And I hope that the people listening to us will enjoy what they hear.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Mike Tedeschi is a well-known barrister, QC, and New South Wales Crown Prosecutor. He's written a book. It's called Eugenia. And on the cover of this book is an old photo from the year 1920. It's of a man in a suit. The man was known in Sydney by the name of Harry Crawford. Harry looks like a typical bloke for his time, wearing a rumpled three-piece suit with sad, watery eyes and a down-in-the-mouth expression. Harry Crawford was married twice, but there was one really important fact that he concealed successfully from both those wives for years. And that was that Harry was actually born as a woman by the name of Eugenia Fellini. Harry was married for years to his first wife, Annie, before she found out that Harry was, biologically at least, a woman. And then Annie was found dead. The murder trial that followed was one of the most sensational criminal trials of its time. Mike Tedeschi, hello. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Richard. Thank you very much.
How did you hear about this extraordinary case?
Oh, look, I first came upon the case of Eugenia Fellini in 2005. We had the 175th anniversary of the Crown Prosecutors, and we had a gala dinner, and I prepared a speech for the dinner. And I decided to identify the four most significant trials that had been prosecuted by our predecessors over the 175 years, and Eugenia was one of them, and that's how I first came upon her.
What was in the record somewhere, or did someone tell you about it? Was there word going around about this case amongst the legal fraternity in New South Wales?
No, there was no word going around about it. It had largely been forgotten. I did some research into old cases that had been prosecuted over the years, and I came upon this one.
Let's talk about Eugenia Fellini, this remarkable person. Where was Eugenia born?
Eugenia was born on the outskirts of Livorno, which is on the west coast of northern Italy. And she migrated with her parents when she was two or three to New Zealand and spent most of her, or all of her childhood and adolescence in New Zealand.
What was the family like?
They were very working class people. Her father worked, he was actually initially enticed to come to New Zealand to work on the railways that were being built, but he worked as an express man, which is delivering the mail. He worked as a delivery person. He basically was a working class man.
Big family too?
A huge family, although Eugenia was the first. She was the first of about 18 children.
18.
Yes. So the youngest ones were actually much, much younger than Eugenia. And I have an interview that was conducted in 1988 with Eugenia's sister-in-law, who was married to her youngest brother.
Do you know when Eugenia began to suspect or say or believe or act like there was something not quite right?
Look, at a very early stage, I would say in early adolescence, she already knew, in my view, that she was a boy trapped in the body of a girl. She would truant from school. She'd go to some local stables where she would work with the horses and ride the horses. And at a very as a young teen, she got a reputation for being better able to handle the horses than the men were.
When did she begin to disguise herself as a man, Mark?
About 15, she left Wellington, where her parents were living, went to a nearby township and got work as a male. And within about a week, somebody came into the factory where she was working, recognised a person who knew the family, and she was not only dismissed, but the police were called. She ended up in court, and there was this terrible scandal. And she ran away from home several times as well.
So early on then she gets this idea that if she is to live as a man, she has to reinvent herself away from her origins then.
Yes, and at the age of about 18, she finally gave up on New Zealand and went to sea as a working seaman on a trading vessel that was plying the Pacific, between the Pacific Islands, New Zealand and Australia.
This was a commonplace thing, commonplace. It wasn't unheard of that young women would disguise themselves as cabin boys or as young male sailors.
I've heard similar tales
is what I'm saying, I suppose.
It's not unknown, but what's very uncommon is to successfully pass oneself off as a male doing the very hard manual labour that Eugene Fellini, which was the name that he used on the ship, that Eugene was doing as a seaman, and he was completely accepted by his fellow sailors.
How did Eugene take to the life?
Oh, he loved it. He loved the open air. He loved the hard work. He loved the camaraderie of his mates. He was very popular. He was fun to be with. He was a hard drinker, hard swearing seaman, a typical seaman of his day.
So this is an ongoing thing. Eugenia, when she becomes a man, she becomes a real man's man in that sense, in the old-fashioned. I'm saying that in inverted commas.
Eugene felt that that was his real identity, that was who he really was. He felt that the female body into which he'd been born was completely foreign and that some terrible mistake had been made.
How long was Eugene able to sustain the story of his maleness on that ship?
On the ship, for about 2 years.
He worked 2 years?
Yes, for about 2 years. He worked successfully as a seaman.
How was Eugene eventually discovered?
Living in very cramped quarters, yes, which seamen lived in those days. Goodness only knows.
Disrobing, I would have thought too, occasionally, you know.
I would have thought not. No, I would have thought that he would have avoided that at all costs.
Yeah. I mean, sailors get their gear off, go for a swim in the ocean and all that, but Eugene got around that somehow.
And somehow he would have managed to do other things that people have to do on a regular basis.
Yes. The challenges involved in that, to succeed at that for 2 years.
But that just shows how convinced he was that that was his true identity, that he was prepared to go to the tremendous trouble that was involved in hiding his bodily identity.
What went wrong?
Look, what went wrong was that he ended up on a ship which had an Italian captain, a fellow by the name of Martello. And Eugenie, of course, came from a family where Italian was spoken in the home, and she spoke perfect Italian because that was her native language. So, of course, Eugene Fellini on the ship struck up a friendship with this Martello, and they were conversing one day, and he made a terrible error, an error of language that you wouldn't be able to make in English, but it's an error that could easily be made in Italian. And it's the sort of error that a native-born person would never make. And it disclosed to the captain that, as a child, Eugene was a female.
What using gendered language or
That's
something?
That's right, using gender language that disclosed that as a youngster, she was a female.
What happened then once the captain realised that Eugene was in fact Eugenia?
Look, we know indirectly from a couple of sources that she was raped, viciously raped by the captain, and as a result of that, she became pregnant, and she was eventually offloaded by Martello at Newcastle, where, of course, she knew nobody. It was a foreign country for her, and so she was left on the docks of Newcastle, destitute, pregnant, and completely alone.
Oh, man. You can imagine that's just awful. Going through... We'll call him Eugene now. We're going to flip gender at the
time.
Well,
now it's back to Eugenia, because she's now a female because she's pregnant, you see. So she has to resolve this problem of being pregnant. And what she did was she had heard of an Italian couple living in Sydney who had no children and who were quite wealthy. And she made her way somehow from Newcastle to Sydney. And the wife in this couple took pity upon her and took her in to their home and looked after her during the pregnancy. And in fact, Eugenia gave birth to her one and only daughter, Josephine, in the home of this woman in Double Bay. Having delivered the baby, she then had this terrible predicament of what she was going to do, and what she eventually decided to do and was successful at doing was to convince this Italian couple to take on Josephine virtually as their own child.
What happens then? How does Eugenia become a man again?
What happens then is that having given up this child and having made satisfactory arrangements for this child to be looked after, Eugenia then adopted a male identity as Harry Crawford. And Harry Crawford maintained this identity for the next 22 years, from 1898 until 1920. And during those 22 years, Harry lived in Sydney, lived the life of a typical working-class man, predominantly in the inner western suburbs, around Balmain and suburbs like that, and did very tough physical work, worked in factories, worked as a general rouseabout in bars, again was very popular with his fellow workers, popular with his mates, lived in boarding houses, and successfully maintained his identity as a male.
Is Harry still seeing his daughter Josephine throughout this time?
Harry would occasionally come back to the home of this Italian couple in Double Bay and have rather unsatisfactory contact with Josephine. What happened was that when Josephine turned about seven, this Italian woman told her that this man who was occasionally coming to visit her was actually her mother. So you can imagine the effect that that had on a seven-year-old. And Harry found out that Josephine knew his identity, and every time he came to visit, he would badger his daughter, "Don't tell anybody who I am. You call me mother." And this poor girl, Josephine, found these visits very traumatic, and I think she found the whole situation totally confusing.
Harry must have been terrified of being discovered, having this identity, having work, being passing off successfully as a man, being a man to all intents and purposes, having male friends, being living very much the life of a man. He must have been terrified.
Yes, yes. There must have been this constant tension from the risk of being found out and exposed.
Was Harry a dapper gent?
Look, there are a number of photographs in the book, and there's one photograph from about 1910, 1911 that shows him as a very nice-looking man of about late 20s, early 30s. Actually would have been mid-30s at that time. Very well-groomed, very well-dressed, and a very convincing male.
Then Harry gets married to a woman called Annie. Tell me about Annie, the woman that Harry gets married to.
Well, look, before Harry even met Annie, Harry had, after a long period of abstinence, decided that he wanted to be able to go further with women. And he had devised a method to have a type of sexual intercourse with women. And he was very popular with women because he had a gentle side as well as the hard-drinking, hard-swearing side. He was able to talk well to women, and women liked him, and he was good-looking. So, but he never, so far as we know, he never fell in love with any of these occasional conquests until he met Annie Burkett, and that was in about I think it was about 1911, 1912, when he was working for a Dr. Clark, Dr. Gotha Clark in Warunga, looking after his horses and his sulkies, and he would drive the doctor around on his home visits. And Annie Birkett was working as a home help for Dr. Clark, and they met. And for about a year, Harry wooed Annie. Annie had been married before but was a widow. Her husband had died from an illness. She had a 10-year-old son, and Harry went to great pains to take them on outings that the son would enjoy and that they would all three of them enjoy. And he went to a lot of trouble to woo Annie, and eventually she agreed to marry him.
Now, this is the thing we have to know, and you know, block your ears if you consider this stuff a little bit sensitive, but how on earth did Harry sustain a successful marriage? First of all, how did he keep his biological gender a secret from the woman he was married to?
Look, I think that if a sailor can keep his gender, his true gender or biological gender, a secret in the close confines of the crew quarters on a ship, maintaining your identity in a house wouldn't be all that difficult. He was renowned for being very prudish and very sensitive about never being seen in the nude.
What about the breasts?
Look, he would bind them, and obviously he had very he was quite flat chested. In those days, you've got to remember a lot of sexual activity was in the dark. There was no touchy touchies.
Would have had to been very dark, I think, under the circumstances, wouldn't it? Yes. If you're trying to fool someone about what's going on where.
And he had fashioned what today we call a dildo.
What was his name for it? Or what was it called, I suppose?
Look, in those days, they used euphemisms for dildos. They were readily available for sale for women who were suffering from hysteria. It was considered to be a remedy for women suffering from hysteria. And it was not considered to be in any way embarrassing for a woman to walk into a chemist and buy one of these things to treat her hysteria.
Wow, it's an enlightened times. Isn't that a marvellous thing? So, but of course, using this article would have had to have employed it, but not in such a way that his wife would have known.
Yes, he would have employed it very carefully, and he would have been very careful how he put it on, how he took it off, and what his wife was allowed to do during intercourse. And look, he was married to Annie Birkett for 3 years without her realising his true identity.
Wow. That's extraordinary.
It is, right.
That's extraordinary.
Yep.
I suppose in those days it was more common for women to be sexually naive as well.
That's right.
And she'd been married before but would only have had experience with probably with one other man in her life and not
that's
really
right.
have known. And I suppose it would have been easy to get women to shy away from asking questions by adopting a prudish attitude, saying, let's not talk about such things, and that's vulgar, I
that's
suppose.
Right. That's exactly right.
Wow.
Yes, yes.
That's extraordinary. The article in question, and it was called the article in the trial,
yes.
I have to ask. I'm sorry, I do have to ask. Have you seen pictures of this?
Oh, look, I have seen an object in the Justice and Police Museum in Sydney, which is labelled as the article from the trial of
the
Eugenia
article. That's
Falim.
Its official title.
That's what it was called
the
in
article.
The trial. It was called The Article. That's the only name that they used. I don't believe that it's the real item, and the curator of the museum doesn't believe so either. One of the reasons is it's about 30 centimetres long.
Oh, my God.
And it's much too big, and it's not the sort of thing that you'd be able to use in that way. I think what's happened is that somewhere along the line, somebody has taken has has sampled the item as a piece of historical interest and replaced it with a draft excluder or something like that.
Mark, how was Annie eventually told? How was Harry found out?
Look, what happened was that eventually Josephine came to live with Harry and Annie.
Harry's daughter, yes.
Harry's daughter, that's right. The Italian woman had died. Josephine had fallen on very hard times. Harry was then forced to tell Annie that he had this daughter, which came as a complete surprise to her, and Josephine came to live with them. And Josephine was constantly being bombarded by the neighbours. Oh, where's your mother? Why doesn't your mother live with your father? And what happened to your mother? And why don't you see your mother? And constantly being bombarded. And finally, in utter frustration one day, she yelled back at a neighbour, "That's my mother across there, living her life as a man." Or words to that effect. We actually know the exact words that were said. And, of course, the neighbour was deeply shocked. And finally, either through a sense of responsibility or because of purient interest, went to Annie and told her what she'd been told. And you can imagine Annie's reaction. Initially, she was disbelieving, and then she thought back to some things that had happened in their marriage that she'd just kind of overlooked at the time, but now they made much more sense. And finally, she came to a realisation that what she'd been told was the truth. And she was then caught in this terrible bind, because she realised quite accurately that if it came out that she'd been married for 3 years to a man who was really a woman, she would be the laughingstock of the nation. And there'd be this terrible scandal which would engulf not only her, but her son. And she was desperate to try and find some way out of this predicament without causing a scandal.
Did she confront Harry about this? I mean, I can see a kind of a rationale for her not saying a thing under the circumstances, but did she actually confront Harry?
Look, she did confront him, she did confront him, wanting him to prove that this story that she'd been told was false, and Harry just fudged and refused to produce the evidence, as it was. And it was then that she finally realised that what she'd been told was the truth. But they lived together under the same roof in a sort of a truce situation. It's what we would call today a divorce, but still living under the same roof. A separation, but under the same roof. And they lived in that condition for 8 months, with Harry desperately hoping that he could convince Annie to stay in their marriage, and Annie desperately seeking a way out.
Conversations with Richard Feidler.
They went on a picnic after 8 months of living under the same roof in this uneasy truce, and they went to the Lane Cove River Park, which actually had some significance for them because that was one of the places that Harry had taken Annie and her son when he was wooing Annie. And they went to a picnic spot, which was quite remote, in a part of the park that very few people would come past. And it was during that picnic that Annie died.
What are the facts of that? What is known beyond all doubt about the death of Annie?
What's known beyond all doubt is that her body was burnt beyond any recognition. There were very few items that were left at the scene, and the cause of her death could not be established. Her body was found about 3 days later. It was taken to the morgue in Sydney, where it was examined by two forensic pathologists, Dr. Palmer and Dr. Sheldon, two government pathologists. And they assumed that this was a case of a vagrant woman who was living in the bush, who'd got drunk and fallen into the fire and burnt to death. Because those sorts of things happened quite regularly in those days. People who were getting drunk would often fall into fires and die accidentally. So they assumed that it was a case of that, and they recorded their findings that there were no signs of any violence whatsoever. The police published a photograph of her shoes in the paper because they had some unusual patches, repair patches on them, hoping that somebody would recognise the shoes, but nobody did. Nobody came forward. The body was buried in a pauper's grave, and the few remains that were found on or near the body, including some jewellery and including a small part of her coat and a cup and a picnic basket, were taken to the Chatswood police station and placed in storage. And that's where all that remained for 3 years. So for 3 years, this body was unidentified.
Was any report made of Annie as a missing person?
No, and the reason why was that when Harry went home to where they had been living in Drummoyne, in a house that I've identified, he told everybody that Annie had left him. He told Annie's son that she'd gone to live with another family in North Sydney. He told various people different stories. Some people, he said, that Annie had gone off with a plumber. He told a whole lot of stories about where Annie had gone, and people basically just accepted that Annie had had enough of this man and had gone off.
So what does Harry do next now that Annie is dead?
Well, Harry was absolutely devastated at the death of the love of his life. He spiraled down into this terrible depression.
How do you know that? I mean, Harry's told everyone that she's just gone to live elsewhere, but clearly he has some knowledge of the circumstances of her death and knows that she's dead?
Yes, he knew that she was dead. And he kind of went from job to job. He went and lived, he moved out of where they'd lived together in Drummoyne, and he went and lived again in boarding houses. He initially lived in a boarding house with Annie's son. He was so depressed, so desperate, that at one stage he took this son to the Gap at Watson's Bay, intending to jump off the Gap with this son, thinking that this poor young boy would be better off dead because his mother had gone, and of course his father had died some years earlier. But eventually he couldn't bring himself to harm the boy, and he took him back to the boarding house where they were staying. A few days later, he again decided that this boy had to die, took him to some sandhills in Wallara, again couldn't bring himself to do anything, and took the boy back. And then eventually he took the boy to the home of another Italian family called, I think it was Bombelli or Bombardelli, something like that. Again, a kindly Italian woman who knew his family in New Zealand, who agreed to take on this young boy who at this stage was 13, who was Annie's son. He then went and resumed his fairly itinerant lifestyle, working in factories, working in pubs, living in boarding houses, moving around, not having any really serious friendships or contacts with people. Until finally, in I think it was 1918, he met another woman called Lizzie Allison. And Lizzie was working in a hotel doing bookwork in the office where he was working as a general hand. And they fell in love. And she was very different to him. She was quite intelligent, quite educated. She was what today we would call middle class.
And she was 52, that's the other thing.
She was 52 and had never been married. And here was this man who was in his, I think he was 46 at the time. She must have thought that all her Christmases had come at once. I mean, both wives did, because with Annie Burkett was a widow. Now, to marry as a widow with a son, with a 10-year-old son, she must have thought that all her Christmases had come at once. And here's the second wife, Lizzie Allison, who's reached her early 50s, unmarried, and this very presentable, very nice-looking, very charming man falls in love with her.
So they're happy. They're happy.
They lived a very harmonious, very happy life for, it was nearly 2 years.
And then one day, Harry's working at the Empire Hotel in Annandale.
Which is still there.
Which is still there, and the police arrive.
The police arrive, and the reason why they arrive is that Annie Burkett's son has finally been told by the Italian family that he's been living with that your stepfather, Harry Crawford, is really a woman. And it so shocked him that he went and visited his aunt that he hadn't seen for a while, and together they then worked out that something awful must have happened to Annie Burkett. So they went to the police. The police made some initial inquiries, and then the police officer in charge of the investigation, Sergeant Robson, then went to the Empire Hotel to bring Harry Crawford in for questioning. And by then, he'd managed to get all of the items that had been found in the Lane Cove River Park from the Chatswood Police Station. He'd shown them to Harry, to Annie Burkett's son and the aunt.
And they'd
identified them as being Annie. So finally, after 3 years, the body had been identified.
So there's Lizzie, his second wife, who has no idea of any of this, has been living happily married again for Harry?
Yeah.
Under these circumstances, no idea. What did the police tell her?
Look, eventually she came to the police station after Harry had... what happened is that the police brought Harry to the police station from the Empire Hotel. They questioned him. He made a statement. He signed his statement. And then there was this incredibly strange interchange between Sergeant Robson and Harry Crawford, during which Harry Crawford's true gender emerged. Now, Sergeant Robson had an idea that there might be something strange here because he'd been told by Annie Burkett's son and the aunt that they suspected that Harry Crawford was a woman. And he very, very shrewdly used this to his advantage to try and get Harry Crawford to confess to having murdered Annie Burkett in the Lane Cove River Park. But Harry Crawford didn't confess at all. But it was during the course of this questioning that Harry Crawford's identity as Eugenia Fellini emerged. Then they took Eugenia back to the house at Stanmore where Harry had been living with the second wife.
As Eugenia?
Well, by that stage they knew that she was Eugenia, but Eugenia was still dressed in the same clothes that are on that photograph on the front of the book.
Three-piece suit, shirt and tie, okay.
Because those were the clothes that he'd been working at the Empire Hotel. They take him back to his home. They search through what's known as a portmanteau, which is a big trunk where people used to keep their treasured possessions. And hidden in a cloth bag, they found the article. And he begged them not to show the article to his wife, Lizzie. So they took him back to the police station. And, of course, Lizzie follows to the police station wanting to know what's happened to her husband. So they delegate the task of explaining things to Australia's first female police officer. She goes to Lizzie and says, well, look, I've got two things to tell you. The first is that your husband has been charged with the murder of his first wife. Now, that came as a total surprise to her because she didn't know about any other wife. And then this constable, I think it was Armstrong or something like that, this first female police officer then says, well, actually, your husband is a woman. And she laughed and said, well, I know that you're wrong. And the reason I know that you're wrong is that I'm pregnant to him. She thought that she was pregnant to Harry.
She's in her 50s,
and she thought she was pregnant. Now, because people were more naive in those days about menopause and things like that, and it wasn't until weeks later that she goes to her doctor, and her doctor says to her, you're not pregnant. You're going through what was then called change of life.
Now, when this story comes out, what kind of a scandal does this create amongst the press of the day in 1920?
Well, Eugenia Fellini was then charged with the murder of the first wife, Annie Birkett, and the newspapers went ballistic. They treated Eugenia as though she was some being from outer space that had landed on Earth, been captured and placed in a cage in the zoo, and was on display for all and sundry. It was just terrible. It was just awful. The language that they used to describe her was just so awful and so prejudicial to her getting a fair trial. So by the time the trial came on, about 3 months later, the whole of Australia knew not only about this supposed man-woman, and it became known in the newspapers as the man-woman case, but they also knew about the sexual deception that Harry had perpetrated on both of his wives.
What, the article you're talking about, that was a subject of discussion in the papers?
No, the article was not mentioned until the trial, but it was kind of it was never explicitly stated because it was not the sort of thing that you could print in the newspapers. Women would faint at the thought of something like that being used by a woman pretending to be a man. It was too scandalous.
Particularly if it's 30 centimetres long, too.
But what happened was that by the time it came to her trial, she was more on trial for being what was viewed by the by the newspapers as a sexual pervert.
Right, freak of nature and
a freak of nature, as for the murder.
The trial had some pretty strange elements. Tell me about some of the odd things that happened during the trial. Well,
the trial was prosecuted by the very first senior Crown prosecutor. So he was my very first predecessor. His name was William Coyle, KC, and this was the very first big case that he did as the senior Crown prosecutor. He'd only just become a KC, which is a King's Counsel, the equivalent of our Queen's Counsel or senior counsel. Eugenia was defended by a defence barrister called Archibald MacDonald, who was really out of his depth. As opposed to that, William Coyle, the prosecutor, was a very, very skillful advocate and had loads of experience. And Eugenia really was very badly represented by Archibald MacDonald. There were some parts of the trial that he did very well, but there were other things that he let go, that he let pass by without objection, that were highly prejudicial to Eugenia. There were issues that he didn't raise. He focused his attack on the very strongest part of the Crown case. That was, he was suggesting that this body was not Annie Birkett. Now, there was one thing where there was an abundance of evidence, and that was that this body was Annie Birkett's body. So he focused on the wrong issue.
There was one moment during the forensic expert's testimony. The forensic expert did something extraordinary.
Yes, this was one thing that, honestly, if it happened today, if a prosecutor did this, or if a witness did this today, it'd be the end of the trial. You'd have to pull up stumps and start again 6 months later. The forensic expert was Dr. Palmer, Aubrey Palmer, was trying to explain to the jury how Annie's body had been dug up and he'd done a second post-mortem with Dr. Sheldon, so the same two doctors, and the second time they found some cracks in her skull, seven of them, and six of them they thought had been caused by the heat of the fire, but the seventh one they thought could have been caused by an act of violence. So having said in the initial autopsy there were no signs of any violence, both these doctors changed their opinion and found this one blow to the head that they said could have been caused by violence. Now, in order to explain this crack in the head, Dr. Palmer leant down to a bag that he had on the floor and pulled out a skull and said, "This is Annie Burkett's skull. Let me show you where the crack is." And he then goes to the jury box and points out the cracks in the very skull of Annie Burkett. So the jury is confronted by the very skull of the deceased person, Annie Burkett. Now, of course, that would never happen in a trial today. But it was, you can imagine, that became an exhibit. And it would have gone into the jury room with the jury while they were deliberating. And you can imagine the effect it would have had on the jury to have the deceased skull staring at them, sitting on the jury table in the jury room while they're deliberating.
So the verdict was a foregone conclusion. Of course, Harry / Eugenia is found guilty. What do you think actually happened to Annie, his wife, and how she met her end? What's your view on that?
Look, the view that I take is that you have to give Eugenia the benefit of the doubt, because that's how our legal system works. And with the benefit of doubt, we can't say how Annie Burkett came to die, whether she fell, whether she was struck on the head, whether she accidentally fell in a fire, or whether she died by some other means. All that we know is that that her body was burnt. Now, because of that, we can't exclude the possibility of an accidental death. And what I've written in the book is a version of the facts that's consistent with all of the evidence that was led in the trial, that gives the benefit of what should have been the benefit of the doubt that Eugenia should have got during the trial.
We're not in a courtroom right now. These matters are not before the law. Nonetheless, the probability, I think you'd have to say, though, the high likelihood is that in a panic, very likely Harry struck Annie, blow to the head, that Annie indeed was killed by Harry. That does seem to be the most likely conclusion.
I think it's highly unlikely that Harry deliberately killed Annie Burkett, because the place where he took her was a place where it was impossible for him to bury the body, impossible for him to carry it away and dispose of it somewhere else.
Killing, though. I mean, that seems more likely, doesn't it? I mean,
we just don't know.
So what happened, though? Having been found guilty, there was the death sentence in those days.
Yes.
What happened to Harry, Eugenia, when the death sentence, the verdict came in of guilty?
The death sentence was imposed because it was mandatory. About a month or two later, it was commuted to life imprisonment after her appeal had been unsuccessful. And she, immediately after her conviction, she was taken to what was known as the Women's Reformatory at Long Bay Jail. And she remained there for 11 years.
What kind of life did, as Eugenia again, which she was forced to become, what kind of life did she have in that prison?
Look, I don't think that prison life was pleasant, but there were some aspects of her life in prison that in a sense were easier than life on the outside. Being in a women's prison, she was accepted for her eccentricities, if I can call them that, more readily than she had been on the outside. A lot of the female prisoners were prisoners who had the most acute problems of their own. So her problems or her identity issues, in a sense, didn't play nearly as much of a role on the inside as they would have on the outside.
So they're tolerated. And so she finds a kind of degree of tolerance then.
Exactly.
As Eugenia. Does Harry / Eugenia fall in love again in prison?
Look, Eugenia had a friendship in jail with another prisoner by the name of Dorothy Mort. Dorothy Mort was completely different to Eugenia. Dorothy Mort was from Sydney's high society. She came from one of the most prominent families in Sydney, a very, very wealthy family. Dorothy Mort had been having a sexual affair with her GP, who was a very prominent cricketer, for some years. And one day this prominent cricketer and GP came to her home and said that he was ending their relationship because he'd got engaged. She was so incensed, she got out a revolver and shot him dead. She then attempted to kill herself by shooting herself in the breast and took an overdose of laudanum.
As it was, yes.
As it was, which was, again, a common remedy for women suffering from hysteria. And she didn't succeed in killing herself, so she was taken to Royal North Shore Hospital. She was revived. She was prosecuted for the murder of this doctor, and she had a very, very good team representing her. She was found not guilty on the grounds of mental illness, but she ended up in the same jail as Eugenia, and she was only released in 1929. But when she was released, she then took up Eugenia's cause and got together a group of high society women to lobby the government to have Eugenia released.
So Eugenia is released. What kind of a life then, after all this, did Eugenia have back in the outside world?
This is the part of her life that we know the least about. She changed her name to Jean Ford. She lived a rather reclusive life, but...
As a man?
As a woman.
As a woman. Oh, Jean with a J, in other words, not a
Jean with a J. It was a condition of her release that she keep the peace and be of good behaviour. And, of course, in those days, to assume the identity of a man when you were a woman was not being of good behaviour. So she had to live her life as a woman. But she was a very, very successful boarding house proprietor in her own right. She ran very tight business as a boarding house proprietor, did very well and was very successful.
Ultimately, how did she meet her end?
Look, it was very, very sad. She, having been so successful as a boarding house proprietor, having got together a tidy sum of money, I think it was £100, which in those days was a very large sum of money, she had just sold one of her boarding houses. She was on her way to the bank to put the £100 into the bank. She stood on the on one side of Oxford Street and began to cross the road to go to the bank and was hit by a car.
And that's where we come to the end of her story, his story, her story. How have transsexual people responded to the publication of this book? Have they read it? How do they think you've told this story?
Look, I was a bit worried when I wrote it that transsexual people would say, look, you haven't written it properly, you haven't understood her issues. But I've only had very, very positive, supportive comments from people from the transsexual community about how sensitively it's been done and how supportive it is of presenting Eugenia's story in a very positive light.
How significant was this trial? Why do you think it was significant? I mean, clearly, Eugenia wasn't given a fair trial, but why is this so significant to your mind?
I think it's significant because we can see how far we've come in our legal system and hopefully in our acceptance of people who are different. I don't pretend that transsexual people don't meet with prejudice and ridicule today. They do. But I think there are a lot of services and support systems available that weren't even dreamt of in Eugenia's time.
Have you ever been to the spot where Annie was killed?
I have. I've searched many, many times for the actual spot. And in the book, there's a photograph of a large rock, which is where the body was found. And I've been unable to find it. I think it must be buried underneath Epping Road. But if anybody does find it, please let me know.
It's an amazing, amazing story about our history. It's extraordinary. And thank you so much for telling it today, Mark. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Richard.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.